This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Terminal List, a thriller. By Jack Carr. Read by Ray Porter.
For the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who didn't make it back. And for our children who are not yet old enough to read this. There's a man going round taking names. Author unknown. Preface. This is a novel of revenge. The Terminal List explores what could happen when an apex predator, a warrior at the top of his game, is thrown into a situation from which there is no return. It is about what could happen when societal norms, laws, regulations, morals, and ethics give way for a man of extraordinary capability, hardened by war, and set on a course of reckoning. A man who is, for all practical purposes, already dead. This work would not exist without the efforts of my dear friend and writing partner, Keith Wood. Though his name does not appear on the book jacket, this book is as much his as it is mine. On a handshake at SHOT Show in Vegas, we decided to fulfill our shared lifelong dream of writing a novel. This is the result. Due to the sensitive nature of the security clearances I held while in the military as a Navy SEAL, I am required to submit any written material intended for public release, including works of fiction, to the Department of Defense. In order to fulfill that obligation lawfully, this manuscript was submitted to the DoD Office of Pre-Publication and Security Review and was cleared as amended by that office. Throughout the writing process, I took great pains to ensure no tactics, techniques, or procedures were compromised. The last thing I want to do is give the enemy something that could possibly give them an advantage on the battlefield. The government review process exists for a reason, and having had the honor of defending this great nation at war, I am still bound by my former clearances to have my writing reviewed. The government's redactions are included as amended and are blacked out in the novel. While this is a work of fiction, each scene draws from emotions that I experienced during real-world events over 20 years in the military. Those emotions, coupled with time in combat, add an authenticity to the novel that we hope makes for a thrilling reading experience. Though my time as a SEAL certainly influenced our choice of a protagonist, I am not James Reese. He is more skilled, witty, and intelligent than I could ever hope to be. Though I am not James Reese, I understand him. He has the experience, training, skill, and drive to administer justice on his terms. This is also a book about control. The consolidation of power at the federal level in the guise of public safety is a national trend and should be guarded against at all costs. This erosion of rights, however incremental, is the slow death of freedom. We've reached a point where the power of the federal government is such that they can essentially target anyone of their choosing. Recent allegations that government agencies may have targeted political opponents should alarm all Americans, regardless of party affiliation. Revisionist views of the Constitution by opportunistic politicians and unelected judges with agendas that reinterpret the Bill of Rights to take power away from the people and consolidate it at the federal level threaten the core principles of the Republic. As a free people, keeping federal power in check is something that should be of concern to us all. The fundamental value of freedom is what sets us apart from the rest of the world. We are citizens, not subjects, and we must stay ever vigilant that we remain so. Jack Carr, August 6th, 2017, Park City, Utah.
Prologue.
It didn't take a tactical genius to pick the spot. Humans are creatures of habit, and some were more religious about it than others. Accountants, it seemed, were practically monastic in their routines. From June 1st to November 1st of every year, Marcus Boykin lived in his mountain house in Star Valley Ranch, Wyoming. Star Valley sounded far more appealing to the East and West Coast real estate buyers than its previous name of Starvation Valley. It was an enclave of wealthy outsiders in otherwise rural western Wyoming, stuck into the mountainside like a well-manicured finger of civilization, full of multi-million dollar homes in a part of the world otherwise populated by ranchers and cowboys. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Boykin rose early and climbed into his silver Mercedes G550 SUV to drive the 50 miles to the relative metropolis of Jackson. With a summertime population of bankers and hedge fund managers that would rival the Hamptons, it was the only place within hours where he could eat a gourmet meal with an $800 bottle of wine. In Jackson, he could sip lattes and read the Wall Street Journal in the company of fellow seasonal residents from New York, Greenwich, Boston, and Los Angeles. 3 days a week, he could connect with real people in person, instead of waiting impatiently for his friends to comment on his Facebook posts. Dinners at Rendezvous Bistro were far tastier, and the conversation more stimulating than his usual meal alone on the deck, no matter how spectacular the view. U.S. 89 runs north and south through the steep valley that straddles the line between Wyoming and Idaho. Irrigated hayfields near the roadway lie in the shadows of the rugged 10,000-foot peaks to the east, and more gentle hills to the west. Just north of the tiny town of Alpine, the route to Jackson turns east along the Snake River and winds into the mountains of the Bridger-Teton National Forest. At this point in the journey, the jagged ridgelines of the Tetons run nearly to the roadside, like towering cruise ships moored alongside an asphalt pier. 10 feet from the well-maintained road was terrain as rugged as nearly anywhere in the lower 48. The home of trophy mule deer and giant elk, as well as plenty of black bears and the occasional moose. Having never touched a gun or hunted in his life, it would never occur to Boykin that September 15th, the opening day of deer season in Wyoming's Region G, fell on a Monday that year. James Reese had hiked in the previous afternoon from a trailhead on the opposite side of the mountain from the U.S. highway. The trail began near the road as the crow flies, but it was many miles away by vehicle. The vistas of the highway were as close to the remote backcountry as most seasonal residents like Boykin ventured. Though it was only a few hours' hike from his truck, Reese may as well have walked in from a different world. He wore a light pack with a nylon rifle scabbard strapped to the side, high-performance digital camo hunting clothing from Sitka, and the Salomon hiking boots he had worn on countless operations around the world. Walking through the Wyoming backcountry in the traditional sniper's woolly ghillie suit and heavyweight rifle, he would stick out like a man wandering the mountains in a tuxedo. But clad in the garb of a hunter, he was as invisible as a guy in a blue blazer at the airport. The anonymous tip that he'd called in about the moose poachers just south of Jackson would probably occupy every game department cop in the region. But in the unlikely event that he ran into someone of authority, the hunting license and deer tag in his pocket would verify him as just another hunter out looking for muleys on the busiest day of the year. He could have hiked in at night with a headlamp or brought along his night vision, but he wanted to get into his spot before dark. No sense twisting an ankle, or worse, in this rough country, and he was anxious to get started. He had studied the topography on maps and satellite imagery hundreds of times, but he'd still hiked the route 2 days earlier to ensure that it looked the same on the ground as it did from the air. The country was steep and high. It didn't matter how well you were conditioned at sea level. 8,000 feet was still 8,000 feet. He stopped to catch his breath and guzzle water from the hose clipped to his shoulder strap. His legs burned and his lungs were starved for oxygen. His base layer was covered in sweat despite temperatures in the 50s, so he zipped his top down to let some of his body heat escape. He wasn't in a rush, but he moved with purpose. It certainly wasn't the first time he had pushed himself up a mountain to a target. His perch was just as he'd left it, a small, U-shaped slot eroded into the mountainside that could only be accessed from the front. There was very little chance of a hunter or game warden wandering up on his six while he was in position, and he'd have a clear view of anyone approaching from the front long before they reached his hide site. The spot overlooked a saddle of highway that ran between two steep hills. His position was near the top of the second hill if you were driving toward Jackson. Like a cave without a roof, the spot would protect him from the prying eyes of hunters glassing for deer the afternoon before the season opened, and would keep him out of the wind as the temperature dropped into the low 30s overnight. He pulled his rifle out of the scabbard and laid his pack down just short of the mouth of the slot, so his muzzle would not be visible from below. The rifle was an Eccles Legend, built by a master in Utah, whose handmade rifles sold for several months of his Navy salary. It was a gift from his father after his first post-9/11 deployment and was one of his most prized possessions. He had planned to hunt more after he retired and entered the private sector. The rifle was chambered in 300 Winchester Magnum, and despite weighing far less than the sniper rifles he'd used overseas, was even more accurate. Instead of a traditional hunting scope, he had installed a Nightforce NXS 2.5 to 10 by 32 millimeter, the same glass he used at work. The pack supported the rifle's fore end, and a small beanbag steadied the butt. Lying prone with the front and back of the rifle supported, he was able to hold the rifle as steady as any bench rest. As cars and trucks crested the hill to his west, he would dry fire at the driver's position of the windshield to get the timing right. The vacationers and local residents traveling this mountain road in the fall afternoon had no idea that they were in the crosshairs of one of the nation's deadliest warriors. Satisfied that his position was solid and that he'd have the right angle on the target, he retreated to the back of his mountain cubby and fired up his backpacking stove to heat water for his freeze-dried dinner. When the sun dropped below the skyline and the temperature fell by double digits, he crawled into his sleeping bag. He thought about his little girl, all blonde curls, tears welling up in her brave blue eyes as she saw Daddy off on his last deployment. 6 months away, and he would be home for good. Promise. He could still see her face pressed up against the airport glass for one last look as he boarded the plane. The hardest parts of a deployment were the first couple of weeks, when you'd just left home, and the last couple when you started anticipating your return. That it was his last trip overseas made the light at the end of the tunnel brighter. Finally, the end of the train-deploy-train treadmill he and his SEAL brothers had been on for well over a decade. Curled up in his sleeping bag underneath a light show of stars that a city dweller couldn't comprehend, he slept sounder than he had in weeks. No waking up to realize that the nightmare was real. No reaching across the bed for a wife who wasn't there. No hearing the soft cries of a daughter who would never again crawl into his bed for protection from the boogeyman. He was already awake, staring at Orion, when his watch chirped at 0500. A swig from his water bottle and an energy bar would be his breakfast. He got into position behind his rifle and waited patiently for the sun to rise. Marcus Boykin was an early riser, as was nearly everyone in the financial sector. You were either up and at the table in his line of work, or you were asleep and on the menu. He looked at the weather forecast on his iPhone before slipping on a pair of designer jeans and some tan Italian loafers. He wore a Patagonia fleece over his pink Lacoste polo and put on a Yankees cap to hide his bald spot from the 20-something waitress he was currently trying to bed. To him, she wasn't Sarah with the degree in environmental engineering working to save up for her master's. She was the waitress. He'd been unsuccessful in getting into her pants so far, but she was broke and he was rich. One night, sooner or later, she'd get drunk and slip up, and he'd be there to take advantage. Living this far out was part of the challenge, though he knew that to better his chances, he might have to get a condo in town at some point to help seal the deal. He grabbed his keys from the marble kitchen counter and pressed the remote start. It was freezing, and Boykin wanted the SUV nice and toasty with the heater running and the seats warmed by the time he made his to-go coffee and headed out. He opened his giant oak front door and took out his phone to tweet a photo of the orange glow of sunrise making its way over the mountain before he lost Wi-Fi coverage. The cell service was crap until you got to Jackson. He didn't really care about the view. In his mind, the sun would do the same thing tomorrow, but it would make his friends on both coasts jealous, a thought that he relished. As he climbed into the SUV and headed down the mountain road to US 89, his mind turned to thoughts of what he'd say to the waitress when he saw her. Combat is sensory overload, total chaos, especially if you're in command. The noise is deafening, both from the incoming and outgoing fire, while the overpressure of muzzle blasts and explosions rock your body down to its DNA. Men are yelling, not out of fear or panic, but to communicate above the roar. Tracers come in, rockets fly past. Dust from explosions and bullet strikes shroud your immediate world in a tactile cloud of dust. Radio traffic in your ears adds to the storm and demands a conscious response, which means one's actions in the moment must be subconscious. Identifying targets, firing weapons, changing magazines, all must happen automatically, as seamless as steering, shifting gears, and working the gas pedal of a car while talking on a cell phone. As a leader, you must rise even further above the storm and look beyond your own survival. You must direct the fire and movement of the entire element and resist the instinct to become just another gun in the fight. The whole thing is one tacky, psyche blur of constant decision-making. This was the opposite of chaos. Reese's senses registered nothing unnatural, just the calm of aspens in the breeze and the relaxing melody of wildlife easing into another day to a beautiful mountain sunrise. There was no radio, no one to communicate with, just the occasional hum of a car or pickup on the asphalt of the highway. The range to the dip in the road was exactly 625 yards, which meant that the bullet would drop 86 inches in its path from his barrel to the target. The rifle's scope was zeroed for 100 yards, so he would have to compensate for the difference. He came up 14 clicks, 1.4 mils, to make up for the drop. By dialing for the range, there would be no holdover. He could put the center of the reticle right on the target. Fight with every advantage you can get. The winds were light this early in the morning, which was a good thing. Wind calls were always tricky in the mountains, even for a pro. The Kestrel told him it was blowing 2 miles per hour from his left, a full-value wind that required 6 inches of hold. Since winds could shift at any moment, he used the mil dot reticle to hold off for the 0.3 mils. He heard the hum of the tires even before the blue halogen headlights haloed above the highway as the SUV climbed the rise. The silver Mercedes was unmistakably Boykin's. Thank God this guy didn't drive an F-150. The vehicle was coming straight at him, which meant no lead was required, but it was still hauling ass. He didn't have much time to admire the success of his planning. He tracked the target as it came down the hill, just as he'd done with the two other vehicles that had passed earlier that morning. He took a full breath, briefly rested at its peak, then exhaled to find his natural respiratory pause when his lungs had expanded their air, steadying and focusing him for the task at hand. Doing so caused the movement of the scope's reticle to slow from an orbit to a small tremor. Even with a solid rest, it was never as steady as in the movies. The Mercedes hit the flat spot and appeared to stop for a second as he lost the perspective of its forward progress. He couldn't see the driver. Not at this range, and certainly not in this light. Holding just right of the windshield center, he slowly pressed the trigger. His ears heard the shot, but his brain barely registered the sound. The only sensation of recoil was the scope's image jolting into a blur as the rifle rocked skyward. Despite putting rounds into countless men in shitty corners of the world, his body still jolted into fight-or-flight mode, adrenaline surging into his body like a shot of heroin. He had killed plenty of men with his country's blessing in the past. But this time, pressing the trigger meant breaking the most sacred bond of society. He'd just committed murder. The monolithic bullet was a Barnes triple shock made from solid copper and scored inside the tiny hollow point to split into four petals upon impact, like a deadly flower. It was engineered to penetrate deeply on big game animals and worked so well that special operations troops adopted it for use during the global war on terror. When it hit the nearly vertical glass windshield of the Mercedes, the petals sheared off, leaving a cylinder of copper a third of an inch in diameter and still moving faster than most handgun rounds do at the muzzle. It struck Boykin on the bridge of his nose and angled downward slightly as it smashed cartilage, brain, and bone into jelly. It severed the first vertebra and exited the back of his neck, looking much like it did on the way in, before punching through the leather headrest and terminating its flight in the foam cushioning of the back seat. The Mercedes's cruise control was set on 60 miles per hour when its driver's brain ceased sending command signals to his body. His limbs quivered and jerked the way most animals and humans do when shot in the central nervous system, but the Teutonic engineering of the SUV kept the wheels traveling straight up the rise of the highway as if nothing had happened. When it roared past Reese's position, he thought for a second that he'd missed. As the vehicle crested the rise, having accelerated to make up for the steep grade, Boykin's lifeless body shifted forward in his restraint and caused the wheel to turn sharply to the left. The forward momentum, downward slope, and the SUV's high center of gravity created a snowball effect and caused the Mercedes to roll forward on its right front wheel, cartwheeling off the pavement and into the steep shoulder. The sound of rubber and steel meeting asphalt and rock were deafeningly loud, but only one man could hear it. Reese smiled for the first time in many months as he pulled a Ziploc bag from a pocket inside his jacket. Out of the bag came a folded-up crayon drawing with a list of names written on the back. With a tiny stub of a pencil, he crossed the first name off the list and returned it to its home against his chest. Part 1. The Ambush. Chapter 1. 3 months earlier, Khost Province, Afghanistan, 0200 local time. Not one of the guys on the ground had liked this mission. Now, moving to within a click of their target, they had pushed that distraction from their minds and were solely focused on the deadly challenge before them. Glancing at the GPS attached to the stock of his rifle and scanning the terrain ahead, Lieutenant Commander James Reese called a quick perimeter. Snipers were already moving up to the high ground as team leaders joined Reese for a last quick update before the final push to the objective. Even with all the technology at their disposal, things could go wrong in a heartbeat. Their enemy was cunning and highly adaptive. After 16 years at war, the Afghans saying, "The Americans have all the watches, but we have all the time," rang a bit more true than it had in the early days.
"What do you think, Reese?"
asked a huge beast of a man, looking like a creature from another world with his AOR-1 patterned camouflage, body armor, and Ops Corps half-shell helmet with NODs firmly in place. Reese looked at his most seasoned troop chief. The light green glow of the NODs illuminated through the beard on the other man's face, a slight smile that could not be mistaken for anything other than the confident look of a professional special operations soldier.
"It's just over that rise," Reese replied. "Predator shows nothing moving, no sentries, nothing."
His troop chief nodded.
"All right, guys,"
he said to the other four men in the circle.
"Let's do it."
They rose with resolve and moved with the poise of men who were comfortable in chaos, moving up the rocky ridge line to get their teams in place before approaching the target to make entry.
"This is too easy. You are thinking too much again. It's just another mission. And why this feeling? Maybe it's just the headaches."
The headaches had plagued Reese for the past several months, finally prompting a visit to Balboa Naval Medical Center before this deployment for a series of tests. Still no word back from the docs.
"Maybe it's nothing. But maybe it's something."
Reese had learned a long time ago that if something didn't look right, then it probably wasn't. That judgment had kept him and his men alive on many a deployment. Everything had lined up a little too easily for this target. The intel, the offset infill, the current state of the objective area. And why the pressure from higher authority to go after this target? When was the last time a flag-level command injected itself into a tactical planning process? Something wasn't adding up. Maybe everything's fine. Maybe it's the headaches. Maybe it's a bit of paranoia. Maybe I am getting too old for this. Focus, Reese! This wasn't the first time that they had approached a target they suspected was a possible ambush. At one point in the war, when intel had pointed to the high possibility of an ambush, corroborated by multiple sources, both human and technical, Reese would have knocked on the door with a thermobaric AT-4 or a few 105mm rounds from an AC-130 gunship. This was the first time that actual tactics had been dictated from higher, from men who would not be on the ground. Focus on the mission, Reese. One more check with the Tactical Operations Center, a forward-based command, also called the TOC, and a look at the Predator feed. Nothing. Another check with the sniper teams. Nothing moving. Reese glanced up at the military crest of the hill in front of him. Through his NODs, he could see the assault team set and ready to move. He couldn't see the snipers, which gave him cause for a thoughtful smile. Best in the business. Reese keyed his radio and opened his mouth to give the order to move. Then it all went black. The explosion knocked Reese back 10 yards and ripped his helmet from his head as the entire military crest of the hill in front of him erupted in a concussion of violence and death. Teammates, friends, husbands, and fathers who one moment earlier had represented the best special operations force the world had ever known were gone in less than a second. Reese never realized that he was momentarily knocked unconscious. The pain in his head brought him back into the fight before the dust began to settle and the reverberations from the explosion had drifted from the hills. The professional in him immediately ensured he still had his weapon. Check. Next was a mental rundown of his body. Everything appeared to still be in the same place and working. They knew. How? Later, Reese. Always improve your fighting position. His eyes darted around, looking in vain for his helmet and communications headset. Eyes adjusting to the dark, hands moving in a frantic search until finally coming across it in the dirt. Yes. Wait, too heavy to be my helmet. That's because it's not your helmet, it's someone else's, and the head is still in it. Even in the darkness, it was clear to Reese that he was staring into the face of his longtime friend and teammate, the big man with the huge beard and confident smile, and that his head was no longer attached to his body. Reese couldn't stop the tears from welling in his eyes, but quickly brushed them aside. Focus. No time to mourn. Exploit all technical and tactical advantages. Check. Reese unsnapped the chin strap, letting his friend's head fall to the ground, and quickly put the helmet on his own head. Miraculously, the NODs still worked. His radio operator was face down, 20 yards away. Reese could tell from the contorted position of his body that he was dead. Moving quickly to his side, Reese turned him over, checked for breathing and a pulse, knowing that the shrapnel sticking through his right eye and out the side of his head had killed him instantly. Removing his radio man's helmet, Reese ripped off the embitter radio and headset to reestablish communications with the supporting aircraft and his talk. Nothing moved on the hillside. It was as if the sword of death had swept over the entire force. Reese heard footsteps behind him and spun, weapon up, off safe. Infrared laser activated, searching for threats. He immediately checked up his M4 5.56mm rifle as he recognized three of his operators running up to him from their rear security positions. The temptation to run up the hillside was a strong one, but another thought was at the forefront of all their minds. Win the fight. His rear security found new positions without saying a word, forming a tight perimeter around their leader. Reese shut the carnage and death of the ambush from his mind. It was time to act. Spooky 47, this is Spartan 01, said Reese into his radio while looking at the griddled reference graphic attached to his arm. Request fire mission on building D3, 105S, level it. Worn in a similar fashion as a quarterback's wrist coach, the GRG was instead an aerial image of the target area, that allowed him to coordinate and maneuver forces who all used the same graphic.
Good copy, 01, 6 mics out.
The AC-130 gunship had been loitering 10 minutes away so as not to give away the coming assault in the still Afghan night.
Break. Razor 24, request QRF and medevac on my position, Echo 3. Stay off the hillsides. We have multiple personnel wounded from buried IEDs.
One never mentioned the dead in a radio transmission.
Roger 01, headed in for a hot extract on grid Echo 3, 10 mics out.
The QRF birds were two CH-47 helos packed with 15 Rangers each.
Mako,
Reese said into the headset.
Anything on that pred feed?
Nothing, 01, nothing moving on target.
Copy.
Reese turned his attention to his four remaining operators.
Who do we have?
He asked.
Hey, sir, it's Boozer.
I have Jonesy and Mike with me. What the fuck happened?
Ambush. They knew we were coming. Bastards.
We have an airstrike about 5 minutes out and QRF en route.
Sir, we fucking told them this was an ambush. What the fuck?
Sure as hell didn't expect this, though.
Anyone alive?
Not sure. Let's go find out.
Roger, sir. But take it easy. There could be hundreds of IEDs or mines set up and buried up here.
Jonesy, you and Mike stay here to bring in those birds. Boozer and I are going to go check for survivors. Boozer, stay about 15 yards behind me. Step only where I step. We will work our way up there slowly. Tox says nothing is moving on the other side of that hill, but stay alert.
Got it, Reese.
Let's go.
The pair moved together up the hillside, though mountainside was a more apt term. Rocky and steep at altitude and weighed down by 40 pounds of body armor and gear makes for slow going, especially when moving through a suspected minefield.
Spooky, we are moving up from GRG Echo 3 to Echo 8. Anything on the north side of the hill is fair game.
Roger 01, still nothing moving.
Strange. Good copy.
Reese and Boozer inched up the hill, the smell of cordite, blood, dust, and death heavy in the air. Movement to the left.
B, I have movement. Don't rush up. Continue to follow me.
Reese whispered into his radio. Boozer responded by keying his mic twice, signifying good copy. Reese moved in the direction of the movement and what he now identified as moaning. Donnie Mitchell, one of the youngest members of Reese's team, lay dying among the rocks of eastern Afghanistan, his body missing from the waist down. He reached for Reese.
Did we get them, sir?
Donnie said weakly.
I've still got my rifle.
Yeah, you do, buddy. Yeah, you do. Airstrike is coming in now. We'll get them.
Reese sat down next to Donnie and moved to cradle his head in his arms. As the first of the 105s began to hit the compound, Reese caught the hint of a smile on Donnie's lips as he drifted off to Valhalla. Reese looked up, watching Boozer slowly work his way among the boulder-strewn hillside. Behind Boozer, Reese first heard, then saw the blacked-out 47s begin their descent into the valley, where Jonesy and Mike now guided them in.
We will pound the hell out of that compound with air and then move in with the Rangers to conduct battle damage assessment and sensitive site exploitation.
It was then that the gravity of what had just happened began to sink in.
I've lost my team. It is my responsibility.
Reese's eyes began to mist over for the second time that night. He had no idea how bad things were about to get.
Chapter 2.
Bagram Air Base, Bagram, Afghanistan. Reese awoke on his back, his vision blurry, blinking to clear his eyes and soften the pounding in his head.
Where am I?
As he turned his head slowly to try to clear the cobwebs, his eyes came to focus on the tube sticking out of his arm, and he became aware of something strapped over his mouth and nose.
IV. Oxygen mask. Hospital.
Reese attempted to lift himself to his elbows, but was stopped short by a blinding pain in his head.
Reese? Reese? Easy, buddy. Easy.
Reese recognized the voice immediately. Boozer.
Doc, he's getting up,
Boozer yelled down the hall. This place was a far cry from the field hospital tents of the early days. If you didn't know you were still in Afghanistan, you'd think you were stateside at a naval medical center in Bethesda or Balboa.
The only giveaway that it was in the middle of a war zone was the ubiquitous hum of the diesel generators providing 24/7 climate control year after year. Fighting in a country for north of 15 years can do that. Reese pulled down his oxygen mask and looked toward his friend. Boozer was still in his op camis, dirty, smelly, with dried white salt deposits straining through the Afghan grime from all the sweat of the night's mission. But other than that, looking none the worse for wear. Boozer was just one of those guys who never got a scratch. His body armor and weapon were absent, but Reese knew he would have a pistol concealed somewhere on his person.
What happened? How did I get here?
Boozer took a breath, trying not to let a look of utter sadness with an edge of pity cross his face, but failing miserably.
Reese, NCIS is already here. They asked me not to tell you shit. Fuck them, though. Of course I'm going to tell you. NCIS? It's bad, Reese,
Boozer continued.
What's the last thing you remember?
Reese's eyes tightened as he searched his memory banks.
We were on the crest of the hill, airstrikes inbound, QRF and Kazivac coming in.
He trailed off.
Holding Donnie.
Yeah, Boozer confirmed.
That's right. Then the whole valley exploded. They baited us in, Reese. More elaborate than anything we've seen to date. They knew exactly what we would do after the hillside went up. They knew we would level that compound and bring in the cavalry for our wounded and dead. The entire floor of that valley, our exact position in the set point, was wired to blow. They knew when those helos were landing, and they cooked it off. Dash 1 dropped its Rangers, took off, and when Dash 2 came in, they set it off. That second helo and all the Rangers, sir. They got them all.
Reese's eyes stayed focused on Boozer.
Jonesy and Mike?
Reese asked, already knowing the answer. Boozer shook his head.
Sorry, Reese. I wanted to make sure you knew before those NCIS guys got in here. I got a bad feeling from those clowns. What's weird is that their questions weren't about the mission. They were about you.
A confused look crossed Reese's face, which he quickly put aside.
Me? I think they are looking for somebody to hang. It's my take, Reese. Stay strong, sir. You didn't do anything wrong. Hire forced us on that mission. They dictated the tactics. Those are the fuckers that should be investigated. They dictated tactics from the safety of HQ. Fuck those guys.
Boozer always had a way with words. Not one to ever sugarcoat anything, he always gave his honest assessment. As a leader, that was what Reese expected. It is what he owed his troops and his chain of command. Always give your honest assessment. That was how one built trust as a combat leader. Without trust, there was nothing.
Your men trusted you, Reese. And now they are dead. Focus. Something is not right. Something is just not right.
Chapter 3. Lieutenant Commander Reese, interrupted a voice from the hallway with more of a statement than a question. Boozer looked at Reese with an expression that told his commander,
"This is the asshole I was talking about."
"That's me," replied Reese, pushing himself up in his hospital bed.
"Hi, I'm Special Agent Robert Bridger with NCIS," he said, entering the room and nodding at Boozer while at the same time displaying his credentials to Reese.
These guys love to show their creds,
thought Reese to himself. He wondered if they knew the rest of the military thought they were all just guys who couldn't get into the FBI or CIA, but didn't have the balls to be street cops, instead choosing to hide out in NCIS for a career of busting 18-year-old kids who pop positive on the monthly Navy drug tests. Even their name was deceptive. Despite leading with an N for naval, NCIS was not even a part of the Navy. Rather, it was a federal law enforcement agency staffed with civilian special agents focused on investigating naval personnel. No one liked them much.
Boozer stood and, though talking to Reese, stared directly into Agent Bridger's eyes and said,
"See you later, sir. I'll be close if you need me,"
before departing the room, leaving it to the federal cop and his boss.
Reese swung his legs over the side of the bed, slowly getting his balance. Looking at his arm, he yanked out the IV and then rose to his feet before extending his hand to the shorter man. Agent Bridger seemed nice enough, and for all Reese knew, he was just doing his job. Bridger smiled and took the outstretched hand. Good cop, Reese thought. Bridger was dressed in the uniform of those not in actual uniform in a war zone. Pressed tan pants with the requisite olive-green button-up safari-style shirt complete with epaulettes, along with clean beige combat boots. Reese always wondered what the epaulettes were for. His 46 Sauer P229 was displayed prominently on his belt in a scuffed-up black leather holster, probably the result of getting in and out of his desk chair for coffee multiple times a day.
If you feel up for it, Commander, we have a few questions about the mission. I'm sure you understand. We just want to get this wrapped up as soon as possible and get you back to your men.
Or what's left of them, thought Reese. Little quick, isn't it?
Asked Reese, looking around the hospital room.
Well, it's a big deal, sir. We need to get some questions answered for D.C. as soon as possible.
Reese nodded, resigned to take the blame he knew was his. He had always believed that as a leader you shared in the successes, but owned the failure. And when successful, you always pushed the credit down to the guys. They deserved it most. This was an unmitigated failure. His failure.
Mind if I change?
Reese asked.
No problem, Commander. I'll be outside.
Reese took a deep breath and surveyed his room. It wasn't what one would expect to find in Afghanistan. Modern and sterile, it stood in stark contrast to the world beyond its doors. Alone with his thoughts, Reese took another breath and located his clothes, op camis covered in sweat and blood. He picked up his camo Cry Pro top and rubbed the blood-soaked material between his fingers, wondering which of his men the blood belonged to. Reese knew that if anything were really wrong with him, they would have put him in the ER, which was in a different wing of the hospital, behind another set of doors, and always ready for the inevitable next mass casualty event, which had become an all-too-frequent occurrence in the counterinsurgency fight. His weapons and body armor were gone. Boozer would have taken care of them.
Ready,
Reese said, exiting the room.
Okay,
the NCIS man answered. This time he was not alone. Instead, he was flanked by a large but portly uniformed Navy chief master-at-arms, carrying a Beretta 92F pistol in a clean nylon holster. How the Italian gunmaker's awkward 9mm handgun had replaced the Colt 1911 A145 to become the official sidearm of the U.S. Armed Forces, Reese could only guess.
Great. More fake cops, he thought.
Reese fell into step with Agent Bridger as they made their way down the hallway toward the exit. The duo could not have been more different. Bridger stood about 5 inches shorter than Reese's 6 feet. His clean cargo pants and offset shirt were not stained by sweat, dirt, dust, grime, and blood like Reese's. His clean-shaven, pale face was a stark contrast to the taller man's stubble poking through the tough, tanned skin of someone who had spent most of his life beyond the confines of an office. Reese and his entourage pushed through the two sets of double doors, separating the medical world from the Afghan dust, which, no matter how much gravel the U.S. military continued to lay down, got into everything. Emerging into the blazing sun, Reese squinted his eyes and shielded them with his hand, realizing he hadn't had time to glance at his watch and, for some reason, thought it was still night. Reese almost stumbled, as a headache worse than any to date almost crippled him. Almost before he could react, it was gone again.
What were these things?
As Reese's eyes adjusted to the light, Bridger motioned to a parked side-by-side quad, a military-looking version of a golf cart. Bridger climbed into the driver's seat while Reese took the front passenger side. Their silent master-at-arms security got in the back and they moved off toward what Reese assumed would be the base NCIS office. They blended in with the normal buzz of daily activity at Bagram Air Base. Soldiers moving to vehicles, getting ready for a mounted patrol with their Afghan partner force, airmen switching shifts at the airfield, a line of military and civilian contractors forming at the chow hall,
Just another Wednesday afternoon in a war zone. As they cruised down Disney Drive, Reese couldn't help but shake his head at the officers who had to return salutes about every 5 paces as they passed junior soldiers. Even in a combat zone, some brass felt it was important to maintain this piece of military decorum. It made him appreciate the sterile uniform he wore. No rank, which meant he didn't need to return 50 salutes on his way to the PX or gym. Bridger slowed the vehicle and pulled up in front of a structure left over from the time the Russians invaded Afghanistan in 1979. The outside was chipped with bullet holes, whether from the Russian occupation or the current conflict. It was impossible to tell. Funny. To Reese, it looked like the old Russian brig. Fitting. Bridger left the Navy chief outside and led the way into the building and down a hallway lined with offices, each with a similarly dressed agent typing away, sifting through papers or mumbling on the phone. Reese took it all in, noting which way the doors opened, which offices had windows, which agents were armed, until Bridger stopped at the last door at the end of the hallway.
"Please wait here, sir," he said before slipping inside.
Reese was left alone, assuming he was probably being watched by a small video camera surveying the hall. He looked at the BOLO, or Be On The Lookout, printouts on the wall. Most were former Afghan workers who did the jobs too lowly for Americans, namely emptying the porta-potties that baked day after day in the heat of the Afghan summer. Reese had always thought they were some of the best sources of intel for the insurgency, having paced out every corner of the base multiple times to ensure correct schematics for incoming mortars and rockets. The door opened again, and Agent Bridger nodded at Reese to come inside. It wasn't a big room, though Reese noticed immediately that there were no windows and no other points of entry. Seated at a rectangular folding table was a man who didn't offer his hand, but introduced himself as Special Agent Dan Stubbs, while holding out his badge and ID card. Bad cop. Reese took a seat across from Agent Stubbs while Bridger joined the man who was quite obviously his superior. Stubbs made a show of organizing some papers before sliding his thin reading glasses down the bridge of his nose to address the SEAL he had summoned in an obvious power play. It was much darker in this room than in the hall or adjoining offices. Reese's eyes adjusted once again while casually continuing to scan the room. A large stack of papers sat in front of Agent Stubbs and a microcassette recorder lay next to that. A video camera was set up in one corner on a tripod but appeared to not be recording. Agent Stubbs was one of those guys who could be 40 or 60. His hair was buzzed, so it was hard to tell its exact color. His double chin was pronounced enough to notice, and though he did not stand, it was obvious he had a belly not accustomed to daily PT. He wore a black polo shirt under a cheap-looking dark suit coat. Something about his demeanor suggested past military experience, though Reese was skeptical as to the type.
"Commander Reese," he began in an official-sounding voice while pushing a piece of paper across the table. "Before we begin, please acknowledge your rights and sign below."
Reese knew better than to ever sign anything for a federal agent without an attorney present. He also knew that his men were dead and that it was his responsibility. He signed the paper and pushed it back across.
"We are not video recording this interview, Commander."
First lie, thought Reese as he nodded in acknowledgement. Reese knew that the inoperable video camera in the corner was a prop, as was the microcassette recorder on the table. The entire interview was being audio and video recorded by a microphone and camera hidden somewhere in the room. The prop camera was to put the subject psychologically at ease, while the microcassette recorder would be used at certain times to go off the record, a provision that, of course, did not exist.
"I am going to start this recorder for my notes, if you don't mind," continued the fat man.
Reese nodded again, more to acknowledge the theatrics of the scenario than to specifically give his consent for the record. Stubbs made a show of starting the recorder and placing it back on the table.
"This is Special Agent Daniel Stubbs of the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. Time," looking at his off-brand analog watch, 12:56 p.m. Wednesday, June 14th, 2017. I am here with Special Agent Robert Bridger to interview Lieutenant Commander James Reese, Troop Commander, SEAL Team 7, concerning mission number 644, Odin's Sword. Commander Reese, take us through the events surrounding Odin's Sword. Reese started from the receipt of mission and went through the planning process. It had been a TST, or time-sensitive target, meaning it was a fleeting opportunity that needed to be acted upon immediately. The intelligence had come from a single source, which would normally disqualify it from consideration until it was more fully developed. Reese always validated intelligence across disassociated sources, two HUMINT sources coupled with SIGINT, traditional and technical methods overlapping to ensure the target was viable and not an entity using America to settle a personal or political grudge. When Reese had pushed back to his next echelon command, he had been told in no uncertain terms that this was national-level intelligence, which was code for he was not authorized to know where it came from. Reese was cleared for top-secret, sensitive, compartmented information, which meant he could be read into special access programs on a need-to-know basis. Taking your men into battle was definitely need-to-know in Reese's book. Reese's troop had been operating out of an outstation in Khost, bordering Pakistan's federally administrated tribal areas near the town of Miram Shah, a hotbed of insurgent activity as well as a safe haven for terrorists and their enablers. Ever since the high-profile killing of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, cross-border operations were a rarity, and the enemy knew it. Setting up in Khost, developing an indigenous intelligence network, working with host nation partner forces, and kinetically hitting the rat lines that moved people, weapons, and drugs between Afghanistan and Pakistan were the order of the day on this deployment. That is why the alarm bell started ringing when the TST came down the pike. No one knew that area as well as Reese and his team. They had been working it for the past 5 months. None of their human networks or technical intelligence pointed to a Taliban compound in their area of operations. The Taliban were too smart for that. Their senior people could live and direct operations with impunity from the Pakistan side of the border. Something was off. Reese didn't mention his call to Lieutenant Colonel Duke Bray, the Army Special Forces commander of the Special Operations Task Force, of which Reese's unit was a part. Duke Bray was a Special Forces legend and the best soldier one could ever hope to meet. He had been one of the first into Afghanistan after September 11, 2001, part of 5th Group's famed Triple Nickel, riding horses in support of the Northern Alliance offensive that retook Kabul in days rather than the months predicted by the talking heads at home. He had crossed paths with Reese many times over the years, and both men had the utmost respect for one another. Over their private, secure video teleconference, Reese could be as blunt as he wanted with the man he considered both a friend and a mentor. "What the fuck, sir?" Reese had asked when he knew both were behind closed doors and in front of their computers.
"I know, Reese. This is shit. I've never seen this, well, not in a long time. I told CJSOTF to fuck off and that we were not doing it. What's crazy is that it wasn't their intel people pushing it. It's national-level intel, and you know what that means."
Reese knew that meant CIA, and it meant strategic-level intelligence, not the tactical kind they developed on the ground. This had to be important to come down so quickly from that high up.
"Reese, I called in a couple favors at Langley to see if I could get some color on this. Nobody's heard of it. How does a target package look to you?"
"It looks great. That's why I'm questioning it. I've never seen anything this thorough from that high up. And we've never even heard of this targeted individual, but there is sure a lot of intel to back up that he's a serious player with connections to Pakistani ISI, Reese said, referring to Pakistan's intelligence service. "What did Stevens have to say?" Reese asked, referring to the colonel commanding the CJSOTF one level above Bray.
"You know Stevens. He's a good enough officer, wants to do the right thing, but he's a career guy.
He said he had the personal guarantee from Tampa that this was a high-priority mission that has to go tonight. Tampa was the headquarters of both Central Command, in charge of U.S. military operations in the Middle East, and the Special Operations Command, which has the lead on all special operations worldwide.
Wonder who guaranteed them?
Reese wondered aloud.
I don't like it, Reese,
Bray continued, shaking his head.
Wish I was down there with you, Commander, but I'll make sure you have all assets of the task force at your disposal tonight. Your op will be the only game in town.
Thanks, sir.
A dedicated AC-130 and a Pred with Hellfires would be nice.
My staff already has them dedicated to your mission.
Good copy, sir.
We better get to work. Thanks for the support. Godspeed, Commander.
To Reese's surprise, Agent Stubbs did not dig into any of the oddities of where the intelligence originated. It was almost as if that were not even an issue.
Interesting.
As hard as it was, Reese recounted the events once on the ground. The offset infiltration, the reports of nothing moving on target, the explosions, the death. When he was finished, Stubbs's first question was not even about the mission. Instead, he removed a paper from the stack in front of him and pushed it across the table to Reese. "Is this from your email, Commander?" he asked. Reese made no attempt to disguise the anger in his eyes as he looked back up at Agent Stubbs and then over to a nervous-looking Agent Bridger. "Maybe a better question is, what the fuck are you doing reading my personal emails?"
"I will ask it again, Commander. Is this from your email?"
One of the first rules in an interrogation is to always know the answer to the questions before you even ask, and this was most definitely not an interview. It was an interrogation. "This is private email correspondence between me and my wife."
"Not only with your wife, Commander, but with members of academic institutions about ongoing military operations in Afghanistan."
Reese almost couldn't control his eye roll. "You mean Dr. Anna Scott at Naval Postgraduate School and Dr. David Elliott at Johns Hopkins? Subject matter experts in insurgencies and international relations?"
"What did you mean by this highlighted sentence here?"
Stubbs asked, ignoring Reese's questions and pointing to a section of the printed email now in front of Reese.
"It says, I question whether the tactical goals even support our national strategic vision."
"It means exactly what it says."
"And how about this one here?" Agent Stubbs asked again. "Well, let me read it for you. You wrote to Anna Scott on April 9th, and I quote, I couldn't launch a mission today to apprehend a jaywalker with the same amount and quality of intelligence with which we invaded Iraq." End quote.
"Well, Stibbs," Reese began, intentionally mispronouncing his interrogator's name. "Anna Scott is a dear friend and one of the world's leading authorities on insurgencies and counterinsurgencies. She spent much of her life in the field immersed in the complexities of revolution, unlike those actually dictating policy." Stubbs's hand reached for the microcassette recorder and pressed the stop button. Reese knew immediately what was coming.
"Commander Reese, off the record, what is your relationship with Dr. Scott?"
"Unbelievable."
"Strictly professional, Stibbs. You should know that from reading all my personal emails."
"I see." Pressing record on the recorder again. "And how do you explain actively promoting assassinations as an active duty naval officer?"
"What are you talking about?" Reese asked incredulously.
"Back in 2014, you emailed Dr. David Elliott and suggested targeted assassinations as a viable government policy in your capacity as an officer, which is a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice."
Reese looked back and forth between the two NCIS agents across from him. It would almost have been comical had it not been so serious. Reese had had many discussions with subject matter experts in the field of warfare. He felt it was his duty as an officer to constantly study his profession, resist groupthink, question assumptions, and seek out the most knowledgeable people he could across the industry to ensure he was going into combat as prepared and well-equipped as possible. That was what he owed the men under his command. It is what he owed their families, the mission, and the country.
I'm done talking with you two idiots. Am I free to go?
Don't make plans to go home just yet, Stubbs said, leaning back in his chair and exposing his well-nourished midsection.